Hello, and thank you for joining me again today for our very second live promo broadcast on all sorts of different social media platforms and YouTube as well. So thank you for joining me. Today is Geezers of Gear episode number 232. At least it's the promo for 232, which will launch next week on Thursday, March 28th. And today's podcast is brought to you by a new sponsor, Ultimate Support Systems. For over 45 years, Ultimate Support Systems has provided musicians with unique support solutions that are crafted with unparalleled innovation and quality. Ultimate Support has always been determined to invent, design, and manufacture the smartest support solutions and music accessories in the music industry. And that commitment to innovation continues to this day. Be sure to visit ultimatesupport.com, where you can learn all about their solutions for content creators, touring musicians, recording studios, and more. From acoustic treatment to best-in-class speaker stands, Ultimate Support has premium accessories you can count on. And I will add that my new microphone boom arm right here is brought to you by Ultimate Support Systems, by far the best microphone boom arm I have had for my podcast. This episode is also brought to you today by GearSource. GearSource was founded in 2002 with a mission to help global live events businesses move gear around the planet. Since that time, the company has transacted in more than 100 countries and has sold $250 million in sound, lighting, staging, and video gear. GearSource recently completely evolved its platform for massive global growth, enabling 14 different localized currencies, payments held in escrow to protect buyers and sellers, AI-powered logistics behind a new global logistics brand, GearMoves, and so much more. Visit GearSource.com today and expand your access to global markets for your gear and global gear for your markets. Yes, so episode number 232, but first back to talking about ProLights. So this week, ProLights and Sound is going on in Frankfurt, Germany. Certainly one of the best shows in the past. It's questionable as to whether or not it'll be the best show in the future because it seems to be shrinking quickly, sadly, because it used to be probably the biggest sound, lighting, video, staging show in the world. It used to be partnered with Music Messe. It used to be massive, 9 or 10 halls, I think. And it just seems to be shrinking. So we'll see what happens to the future of ProLights. Maybe I'll get somebody on from that show and they can tell me what they're doing, what they're planning, etc. So if anyone knows anyone who's involved in the planning and organization of ProLights, please have them contact producer at geezersofgear.com and Sarah will get us set up for a chat and we can talk about what's going on with the show, what you're doing to protect the future of the show, how it's going to grow, etc. So at that show, lots and lots of new products have been announced. We talked about a few of them yesterday, but also I was reading about the Avo D7. Avolights, of course, recently purchased by Roby, and that is ramping up not only their product development, but their manufacturing capabilities as well. And I think we're going to see a lot of really great things coming out of Avo. You know, it's going to take them some time and effort and energy and people and talent and everything else to catch up to MA on the top end of the market. But I think that middle and lower end of the market, even the top end, but I think the middle and lower end, certainly MA have not expanded to a point where you've completely blocked competitors. And that's allowed really great companies like Obsidian and others, Camsys and certainly Ava Lights, who, you know, is kind of the originator of the rock and roll lighting desk. So we'll see where it goes. Obviously, their D9 is their flagship console, their big, call it the Grand MA of the Avo line. It's been making some noise, but I would say it hasn't taken over the market by any stretch. We'll see what happens again under the Roby banner. It's a much more powerful console than it used to be, just from a standpoint of world, you know, global distribution, global strength, resources, etc. But now they introduced the D7, which I saw in a social media post somewhere. Someone commented that the D7 is a D9 that you can check as baggage. And so it's a very good point. It's basically a mini-me of the D9, which call it the, you know, the MA3 Micro or whatever, similar to that console, I guess. But I expect to see big things from that. Maybe a D7 will give them more of an intro into the large-scale market, the bigger end of the market, and we'll see. You know, again, maybe if someone from Avo, you know, I used to talk with Steve Warren all the time, but I don't know anyone else at Avo. If anyone wants to come on and talk about, you know, the roadmap, where it's going, how the brand has changed, how the company's changed, feel free, again, reach out to producer at geezersofgear.com. And one of my favorite brands, I have a bunch, but this is one of them, Ayrton. And so I am afraid to even pronounce the name of this new product, but Kyalami. And so it looks like a magic dot. It seems to act a lot like a magic dot, but it has a laser light source in it, and it's IP65. They're calling this part of an extreme miniaturization line of product. And supposedly it does a lot of really cool stuff. Lots of effects packed into a very, very small package with a really bright and intense light source, which is a laser. And so that's exciting, you know, seeing Ayrton miniaturize a laser-sourced fixture is really exciting. I think that's a sign of great things to come, not only from Ayrton, but other manufacturers as well. I know a lot of people are playing with lasers right now, and we'll see where that goes. And of course, if the U.S. would ever get our shit together and get the laser lighting fixtures out of the hands of the Food and Drug Administration from a standpoint of you know, it just doesn't make any sense. You know, what do they know about laser lighting and its impact on your eyes and stuff like that? Like, otherwise, you know, they'd get rid of Sharpies and a lot of other beam effects that are probably much more dangerous than some of these lasers. So anyways, we'll see where that goes. I know a lot of companies are certainly lobbying for changes, but we'll see where that goes. Also from Ayrton is a Nando Wash. And neat name. I don't know much about it. I cannot tell you what differentiates the Nando Wash from all of the other LED wash lights that Ayrton has come out with recently. And maybe I'll talk to Ayrton about that and get more information. But I don't really know what differentiates this one other than it's IP65. But they've got other IP65 LED wash lights. So we'll see. We'll have to come back to that one. Looks cool. And lots of IP-rated stuff. One that was a little confusing, GLP announced a bunch of fixtures that have IP in the name, but I couldn't see any IP in the specs. So I would assume that IP in the name, like there's a, there was a bunch of them. And, you know, there's an impression, something or other IP, and just a bunch of GLP fixtures that have IP in the name. And so I assume that that's an IP range, you know, they're weatherproof, but it didn't list that in the specs, or at least from the posts that I was able to see. So moving on to episode number 232, Thomas, and I'm not sure if he pronounces it Kubik or Kubik, but Thomas Kubik, I'm going to call him. And so today's guest was introduced to me by Sarah, our producer, who, I don't know if people know this, but Sarah used to tour, and that was sort of how I got introduced to Sarah to begin with. She was touring, I think, mostly in hospitality and catering, and Sarah met this gentleman, Thomas, on tour where he was working with In Flames, and it was a Five Finger Death Punch and In Flames tour. In Flames is a very heavy metal band. And you know, so they met, hit it off, got to be friends or whatever. And Sarah thought, hey, he'd be a great guest. But it's funny because Sarah thought he was the manager for In Flames because he did so many different jobs with them, as you'll hear in his bio coming up here in a second. And lo and behold, finds out he's the sound engineer. So Thomas started his career 28 years ago, took the classic course from stagehand to behind the console and touring. He has been touring since 1999 with Euro and metal bands, including In Flames, Nevermore, Arch Enemy, Fear Factory, Angra, Lacuna Coil, Moonspell, Chimera, and Willie Nelson's Luck Reunion in Austin. One of those just doesn't fit in, does it? Thomas has been extremely lucky to travel to pretty much every continent. Thomas has been with In Flames for 25 years in June as their sound engineer and tour manager, or in Thomas's words, the babysitter. Thomas loves coffee, wine, and champagne, and generally good food. We'll be finding out a lot more about Thomas's career, talking gear, what he's been up to recently, and what he has in store for this year. So please welcome Thomas Kubik. And for those of you who are viewing this live, I'll see you next week.
In Flames and Five Finger Death Punch. And I was like, kind of like, oh my God, like this is going to be insane. And like, you know, like I'd never like worked with, you know, metal like that. And then I got there and everybody was as soft as anything.
That's well, usually how it is.
They didn't scare seriously. You like you thought metal people would scare you?
Yeah. And literally it was like, I mean, okay.
Did you think they sacrificed babies and burned crosses? And what did you think?
I don't know. I just thought it was going to be like really crazy. But I remember the first couple of days, because of Five Finger, they were like Alcoholics Anonymous, weren't they? So it was like,
some of them,
no alcohol was allowed. And it was your camp that was like, no way, just because you've got a problem, we haven't. And then that all changed.
So they were drinking, vodka out of sippy cups and stuff.
Yeah, seriously. Anyway, it was great. So enjoy the show, guys.
Sarah, any other stories you'd like to share while we're recording here?
I don't think so. Now you've put me on the spot. The only thing I always remember is coming back into the dressing room when everyone has finished, and Thomas would always have a bottle of champagne. Nothing else. Always champagne.
Again, very unmetal.
Seriously. There we are. It's not wine. It's champagne.
It's very unmetal. I mean, unless you're drinking it out of the bottle.
I only do that on very few occasions.
only when you've run out of glasses. All right, Sarah, you're out.
Bye.
We have to get serious now. We can't have you sitting there yapping at us the whole time. So that was an interesting start to the podcast. I hit record while Sarah was blabbing, and I need to do that more often because occasionally she says something brilliant. So Thomas, welcome. Do you pronounce your last name Kubik or Kubik? I would guess Kubik sounds more German to me.
That's although it's not German, I think it's Czech or whatever.
Oh, okay.
Originally, yeah.
Ah,
yeah.
Sounds like there's a story there.
But that's the right Kubik. Pronunciation.
So forevermore it will be Kubik. And I think I said it right in the intro anyway, so that's good. So fantastic. You know, it's nice that we had Sarah here to kind of greet you on, because Sarah, you're the first guest I think that she brought from her camp of people that she met on the road and just thought were really cool people, so she was pretty excited to get you on. So
fantastic.
So thanks for taking the time.
I had no idea that she's doing that now. It was like out of the blue, basically. So
on Crete, there's not so many jobs. I mean, basically, you could collect plastic off the beaches, you could make kebabs, or you could, you know, be a producer for a podcast in Florida. You know?
Yeah. Sure. Why not?
Just not many opportunities, and so she tripped over this one. No, I was introduced from a friend. You probably don't know Gordon, but I was introduced by Gordon, who works with Production Park, and knew Sarah from there. And
okay.
Yeah, we hit it off, and next thing you know, she became. It's funny because I actually put a notice on my Facebook or something saying, "Hey, anybody want a part-time easy gig being a producer for a podcast?" And she was like, "I do."
Yeah.
Would you even Excellent. Consider me? And I said, "You're hired." I mean, not only would I consider you, it's over. So, yeah.
Excellent.
So she says she met you, and we'll just continue down this story, on a tour that was Five Finger Death Punch and In Flames. And she mentioned earlier on this recording that Five Finger Death Punch were, I guess, in recovery, right? So they had...
I get part of it, or parts of them definitely were, yeah. We didn't really get too much into the detail story. Of that either, because usually it's just like, okay,
those
whatever.
Those are always interesting situations, though. I remember like Aerosmith earlier in their career when they first decided to get sober and then fell off and then fell back on and then fell off again. But
when they first did,
they were really religious about it. Like you couldn't have alcohol or drugs or anything within miles of the arena.
No, I mean, Flames being based in Sweden.
Yeah.
And, you know, Scandinavian people are, you know, they like to drink.
Yeah, they're drinkers.
So it's been, it was very surprising on day one that all of a sudden, you know, somebody came up and was like, "Oh, you can't do it. What do you mean we can't? This is like, this is not going to work."
Yeah.
You know, because it's like, that just ruins the mood.
Part of their daily ritual, right? Like, it's just what they do.
Exactly.
You know? It's nothing bad. You know,
I mean, if it would have been communicated in the, you know, in advance or whatever, it would have been a different story, I guess. But would still have been a no, but at least like we would have been prepared somehow that there's something going on, you know.
I get it.
Because this was definitely not the first tour where something like this was going on. Like I remember back in 2003 or 2004. When we did Ozzfest, I mean, there was a daily AA meeting in catering for like, you know, I don't know how many, it was like 200-300 people touring and, in, you know, at I don't know.
Half of them were in the meeting.
Before lunch service or whatever, they had this AA meeting in there. So it's not an uncommon.
Well, let's face it, you know, especially drugs and also, of course, alcohol have been a problem in our industry's past. And
absolutely.
And, you know, so it's a good thing that people who needed help have gotten help. People who needed to stop have stopped. You know, like I see that you're enjoying a glass of wine. You know, to me, at my age now, that's pretty much the extent of my drinking. And a heavy night, I might have 3 glasses of wine, you know, and then it's like, oh, forget it. I'm going to have a hangover if I even touch it, drop more, you know. But it used to be.
It doesn't get any easier
bottles of wine.
No.
But it's a good thing. I mean, it's a good thing. I mean, if I didn't get hangovers or headaches or if it didn't bother me in some way, I'd probably drink a whole lot more, you know, because I do enjoy it. Yeah, but it's just, I don't know, the sexiness of getting, you know, drunk to a point where you pass out, you know, on the floor somewhere where you don't even know where you are. That's just not as attractive as it once was.
Not exactly. Yeah. Not necessarily attractive. Yeah.
So I wonder if you know, because you're in that metal scene, and do you do any like German bands? Like I know that metal in Germany is a big thing still.
German metal bands. Have I worked for German metal
Well, the only
bands?
Reason
I'm
I
sure,
ask,
I'm sure
I,
there was.
I have a very good friend who I kind of grew up with in Canada, who's a drummer. And it was funny because Randy Black.
Randy Black. Yeah. Of course. I know Randy.
Oh, do you? So you have to tell Randy that you were on my podcast because we go back, you know, literally 40 years, him and I. And, you know, so of course, like I don't know if you know this, but before he played in Annihilator, he played in Canada's most popular Rush tribute band. And it was a band called Click. And I was very good friends with all of them. But Randy and I were, we got in some trouble together, let's just say. And I owned at the time a music store, and I did business with them, and they were a client, but they also became very good friends. And the singer and keyboard player, Keith, I'm very good friends with still today, and Randy I talk to quite often. But yeah, before Annihilator, he was a very technical drummer in a Rush tribute band. And then all of a sudden he's in Annihilator playing this crazy metal music. And then he goes on with, you know, all these other bands and ends up with Primal Fear and Destruction. And so.
Yeah. Primal Fear. That was the last ones that I know, I think, where he played. I met him when he was in Annihilator because I toured with, that must have been early 2000s as well. I toured with Nevermore.
Okay.
And they did a European tour together with Annihilator. Okay. And I was on that, and that's where I met him.
Yeah.
And Crazy Jeff Waters it was an interesting tour.
he's in Destruction now and still going strong, you know, touring constantly. Oh,
okay.
And
okay.
Doing
yeah.
all the festivals yeah. in the summer and stuff, of course, but So yeah, it's funny. You know, I got to ask because to me, there are two really challenging jobs, I think, in that type of music. And one is being the drummer and the other is being the sound engineer, you know, because to me, it's just this wall of coming at you and you have to somehow separate all of those sounds and sort of create nuance among mayhem. Call it.
Well, it's not a wall of noise with all the bands. There is good ones and really good ones and not so good ones, just like everywhere else as well.
Yeah.
And it's definitely more challenging with when it's just a bunch of noise or the musicians come with certain ideas on how it should sound that work in a rehearsal space situation, but will never work in a club or let alone arena or something like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I was always pretty lucky, I would say, like mostly that the bands that I work with or worked with either were also we're very young when I started, so it wasn't this, this older guy is trying to tell us what to do. It was always like a experimenting on the same kind of level.
Yeah, they looked at you as a peer, not as somebody trying to straighten them out.
And then once I was in the business for like quite some time and started to work for other people or whatever, I already had a lot of experience for my age because I literally started when I was like 18, 19, basically.
Really?
Like with the whole stagehand situation, even earlier than that.
So were you a musician or something? And then you just...
I wouldn't call myself a musician.
Yeah.
I did play guitar in a band, but I wouldn't...
You weren't very good.
I wouldn't go as far as saying I'm a musician. No.
But what got you interested in working behind the scenes, like in becoming a stagehand to start and then moving your way up?
It was the playing with my band at the time. And it was like pretty obvious very quickly to me that, you know, obviously you have to have a little bit of knowledge of all this so you can communicate with like locals.
Yeah.
And even back then, we wanted to have a good result for what we were doing. And then, you know, that's how I basically got to know the people at the local club, and then, you know, one thing led to another, and it's very typical.
Yeah. No, I mean,
it's a typical career path, I would think.
At least
back then it was.
Yeah, it was. Now it's getting much more where you decide really early on that you want to work in the arts and you go to school and you go to some sort of theater technology classes or something, and you're either in lighting or you're in sound or you're in set design or you're in costumes or whatever, wardrobe. And so now they're like, a lot of the younger people who I have on the podcast have taken a much more planned route into this industry. Whereas, you know, like, you and beyond you, it was much more lucky. Yeah.
I think I was one of the last ones, or like my generation, so to speak, is one of the last ones that like got into this somehow. Because at the time when I started doing this, the schools really didn't exist to do anything of this, like this, you know. I mean, you could go in Austria, you could go to like university and you know, get this master's degree, but it was all very technical as well. It was less of a just like try and error type.
Yeah, you were taking like acoustical engineering,
be creative or whatever. Exactly.
Acoustical engineering, not how to be the front of house guy for a metal band. You know,
exactly.
101.
Yeah. Well, that wasn't really my plan either, but you know, that's just how it happened.
Yeah. I want to ask you about that. Yeah. Like, you know, because you seem to have become typecast, sort of, you know, like how Jim Carrey can only do funny movies. When he does a serious movie, it's ridiculous, you know?
Which is a lie, though. I think he's very good when he does it.
Serious movie. Well, maybe I chose a bad example, you know? But when it's somebody who's only in scary movies or only in funny movies or whatever, it's hard to imagine them. Like, do you watch Larry David, Curb Your Enthusiasm? It's one of my favorite shows ever.
Yes.
Could you imagine him in a serious role?
No, absolutely.
Exactly.
No.
You know, so I have a hard time imagining you working with Willie Nelson. You know? So to me it's similar, you know, like you become known for a particular genre or whatever. And
I think it's mainly, this is mainly down to like your network.
Yeah.
What I was thinking. If you don't work for one of the like big rental companies or whatever, you know, it's usually how it goes. Mm. And then for me, it's a little bit special, so to speak, as well, because I've been with In Flames for so long. And now I started as just the sound guy, then it turned into the sound guy tour manager thing. Then when it got bigger, we got a separate tour manager again, which I really liked. And then for various reasons, he got basically out very short before another tour was coming, or in between two tours, actually. And then that was, I think, in 2015. And they asked me again if I could do it, so we just don't have a stranger on the bus on the next run.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really getting into it again because I wasn't really keen on the job, but it worked out really well, to everybody's surprise, I would say. And then we just kept doing it. But you know, originally I was gonna stick to just the sound, and if I would have done that, I would have a lot more time to do other things as well.
Yeah.
And then I would probably try to get out of the metal a little bit more.
Yeah.
But since In Flames basically kept me busy for 25 years now.
Yeah.
There's very few months or weeks where I can actually decide to do something.
Yeah, it's not like you can book three other tours or something.
Really busy. You know?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, on one hand, it's super nice because it's a very you know, family type of environment. Like I obviously know all their wives and kids and even parents and whatnot.
That's cool.
Which is really nice. And a lot of the crew within Flames has been around for 10 plus years. So it's like, you know, it's basically like
a family, a road family
being on the bus, which has its advantages, but obviously, like all families, there's difficulties.
Yeah, families have good and bad parts, for sure. Yeah, families have good and bad parts. No, that's really cool. And you know, again, I'm not saying that it's bad to get stuck in metal or anything like that, because obviously, you know, you've done well, it's done well for you, they've done well with you, etc. But it's just, it's an interesting observation. And I would guess, again, going back to the genre, like, I would guess that there are some skills or whatever that are required that are different than doing sound for a pop act, or
I don't know. I don't really look at the
console and everything's clipping all the time. Like, I just see red lights flashing everywhere in my mind, right?
Yeah. There's definitely people out there that it looks like that.
Yeah.
But it shouldn't look like that.
vocals, you know, 1 minute a guy's going, ah, la, 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 and then it's like, rah, rah, rah,
rah, rah. Yeah, sure. Yeah. But I mean, you have that in other genres, you have have different challenges.
True.
Yeah. But in the end, it's all the same.
Yeah.
To me, it is. It's like I actually think if you get hired by somebody who's completely, you're not a fan of the music, you have nothing, you would not listen to this at home. I actually think you go into this with a completely different mindset, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it's to me, this is more objective than you know, being a fan of the band that's on stage.
Are you a fan of the genre?
I used to, I would, like, before or at the beginning when I got into it, I would listen to that type of, not necessarily like In Flames, which, you know, they come out of like a death metal, whatever.
Yeah.
That was never really my thing, but like metal in general, I would listen. Or back in those days, it was like the hardcore days, like Biohazard all the, you know, these kind of things. Yeah. I would listen to that. But nowadays I'm happy if there's no music, and if there is music, it's usually not metal.
Yeah,
at all, you know.
Yeah, it's the opposite. It's like jazz or something, right? Something nice.
Yeah, and it's like it obviously like when you grow older, I think the taste gets a little bit broader or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, being from Austria, being from Salzburg, it has the classical component as well that you can't get around and that you hate as a kid and whatnot. And nowadays I'm actually enjoying orchestra stuff or whatever as well.
Yeah.
So it's, you know.
At the same time, like for me anyways, I've always had a pretty wide musical taste, you know. Like I was kind of a metalhead, and you'd walk into my music store and I was listening to Michael Jackson in the 80s, you know, when the Bad album came out, because of the production quality of it, I was just blown away. I was blown away by the production and some of the sounds that were coming out of it. And, you know, so it wasn't so much.
I was about to say, I back in those early days, I used to listen to a bunch of pop albums that just for the production.
Yeah, exactly.
Value.
Exactly. Well, it was the same reason I liked a lot of the 80s bands when they came out, you know, like Def Leppard and Winger, who everyone hated, but I loved because they were just so well produced, you know? And
absolutely.
Some of those producers were just so good.
The metal, especially nowadays, I think is completely like over the top. Like sounds are completely, you know, not, you can't reproduce half of it live. It's just, it
really
runs through chains and chains of fucking plugins and whatnot. It's
really
like, why are you doing this? This is not, you know, this is not necessary.
Yeah. But do metal bands play to tracks?
Yeah. I know very few bands that don't have tracks, to be honest.
Huh.
At least not like you know, the occasional keyboard track or whatever.
It's
some
funny
use it more than others, but
it's so common now. And you know, I'm always surprised when I find out about it, because I'm like, really? Like, those guys who I've always liked so much, they're playing to tracks. And, like you said, sometimes it's just a keyboard track. Sometimes it's maybe some background vocals or something. But but when it's more than that, you know, like when you hear that, you know, on Motley Crue's stadium tour, Nikki Sixx wasn't playing the bass. It was a bass track, you know, and things that.
Yeah.
That's disturbing. You know, that's a bit disturbing.
Yeah. But that's also not very metal specific. That happens everywhere.
No, of course not. Yeah.
And I actually think it happens in pop way more than it does.
Oh, 100%. Most of them don't sing at all or most of the instruments aren't even real, you know.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing. But, you know, back to this genre, which I'm obviously intrigued with because I don't know that much about it. And by the way, like, so you said, as we grow older, we change our taste and stuff. So one of the earliest metal concerts I went to was Judas Priest, probably in, like, I don't know, 1980 or something. And, and I'm listening like crazy to the new Judas Priest album right now. It's so good. You know, Rob Halford is 74 years old or something, and his voice is incredible on this album. Like, he's hitting the notes that he hit when he was in his 20s. It's crazy. And, but anyways, back to the genre. So are there any gear, like things that are uncommon maybe in other types of music? Like, do you have to use different equipment for this type of music, or is it pretty much all the same? Yeah.
No, I wouldn't say I wouldn't say different equipment at all. I mean, a lot of people nowadays go to, you know, the digital amp thing, like, be it Kempo or XFX or a Neural DSP, whatever it is that, you know, that's your preference.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily agree with that trend, because it's not the same yet, you know. I'm not sure it will even get to the point where it's the same to a real, like, tube amp. Maybe in, you know, for the next generation, but not in my lifetime. I don't see that on the horizon anywhere. So I mean, I don't think it's but I mean, what we do different, or we started doing different, and now a lot of people are doing it, is that we use isolation cabs for guitars and bass, which,
really?
for a long time.
Huh.
I know that, like, arena bands or bigger bands have done that for a very long time as well. Like, Metallica, I think, were one of the first ones that did that. I don't remember really any of the smaller bands, or like the bands that were in Flames' size that did that when we started doing it.
And can you explain what that is for people who don't understand?
Yeah, it's a very simple concept, actually.
Yeah.
It's basically just, it used to be just a case where you put the guitar speaker in, and then you mic it in the case, you close the case, so you can lower your stage volume, and therefore you have more control over the actual guitar tone.
Yeah.
And the, like, how loud your stage is.
Yeah.
And we started using it shortly after the guys decided that they want to use in-ears.
Yeah.
Like in-ear monitors. And then that made the most sense to do that. And the ones that we are using now is like a purpose built that is basically speaker cabinet and case in one unit. It's just, it just has like three connectors in the back, two for the mic, one for the actual speaker, and then that's it. It's got one like 12-inch speaker in it, and that's it.
Yeah.
And I mean, that drastically improves the quality, especially on smaller shows, for instance, because the stage gets so much more quiet that you can actually, on front of house, you know, actually mix. And on bigger shows, it's much better also, because like if you listen, I record all the shows on multi-track.
Yeah.
And if you listen to the guitar, that's it. There's only guitar. There's no bleed from the drums. There's nothing else. There's no.
Are you also isolating drums though?
No. But I mean, the only noise that's on stage literally is the acoustic drum kit.
Yeah.
And a little bit of side fill, which also has mainly drums or whatever. There's nothing else that's going on stage. We still have guitar cabs, so you know, when they need to do like some feedbacks or whatever, they can do that, but they're obviously on a way lower level than what you would have them if this would be your main source for the mic.
Yeah.
So
well,
I really think that makes a big difference. Yeah. And a lot of other bands started to adapt that after a while.
Well, you said something that I think is key, which it just gives you more control, you know, because if everybody's just, you know, got everything turned up to 10 and it's just a bunch of noise on stage, you know, obviously it makes your job more difficult, especially for the first 5 or 6 rows, you know, in front of the stage where they're hearing sound off the stage, not out of your.
But it's like, for me, this is also, it's always been like that. I'm a big fan of dB limits. Mm. I always was, as long as they're implemented in a like sensible, way.
Yeah.
Because like when I started, it was already like Switzerland had them as long as I can think, ever since I've been to Switzerland for
how
the
many
first time.
Decibels? What's their limit?
It's, I believe it's 90 average over a certain period
from,
of time
from the toilets.
unless you provide free hearing protection, then you can go to 99 or 100.
Wow.
That's and nowadays I don't know the exact law, but it seems to be like pretty much like 100 over like 15 minutes or half an hour, which is more than enough.
Yeah, but it's quite low compared to what I'm used to when I grew up, you know, with the walls of speakers, you know.
Yeah. That whole technology just completely, that changed so much in the last 15, 20 years.
Well, especially, you know, because of line array and stuff, right? Like it's a much more scientific approach.
Yeah. Because of line array, obviously, also it got way more precise even once the line arrays were already there.
Yeah.
Now the new thing basically is like beam steering or like cardioid systems that only really throw in one direction, where again you just don't have any spill back on stage, you don't have that much like secondary noise, so to speak, and it just gets everything else, it cleans it up really nice.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that technology. So speakers are just very narrow.
They started this with the sub speakers, because obviously the lower the frequency gets, the more of a circle the dispersion is, so to speak. And so cardioid subarrays were like the first step in that development, basically. And then this German company, DMB, actually released a system that would do the same thing, but not only for the sub frequencies, it does it over basically the whole bandwidth.
Yeah.
you know, so all this like muddy, everything below 300-400, whatever, everything that, you know, just basically makes it difficult or makes it more difficult in arenas and stuff, is basically gone or improves drastically. And that combined with a very precise software to calculate where you need your speakers to hit, just makes an overall difference. You know, it's this little pieces, like the isolation cabs is just one of them.
Yeah,
And then this speaker technology and this and this and this and this.
Yeah,
that just makes it a completely different. Like if you want it to be, and if the artist or the musicians actually want this to be the best it can be, there's a lot you can, there's a lot of technology that you can utilize it's these days that hasn't been there like 5-10 years ago. It's crazy.
It's very, very interesting, because like I said earlier, nuance to mayhem or whatever, but it's adding precision, you know, to mayhem. So, you know, what's being played might be very confusing and noisy and everything else, but then you start to really kind of tighten everything up, first of all with isolating sounds on stage, but then, you know, the system itself being able to do even more of that in a much more direct approach.
And I mean, it was for me, this was very funny, because once we switched to this new PA technology, on one tour, it was actually the tour in 2017 with Sarah. This is we had a pre-release system out. It wasn't really a beta test, but it was almost finished, but it wasn't released yet. Yes, exactly. It's called GSL.
Okay.
They actually gave us an arena system. They sent one of their guys out with it to help out with like our systems engineer to like set it up and straighten it out. And it was basically for them, it was like a field test. Like, we know it's, you know, the product's ready, but how does it do? What's the little things that we still need to tweak a little bit, you know, being like how quick you can rig it. Or like small adjustments in the software that controls it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And on those first shows, I remember that it like for me, it was like, oh my God, I actually have to clean up my mix. I can hear things now that I couldn't hear.
Wow.
Systems. It's like, it actually, in the end, work for me, because it was just like, okay, what is this, you know? And I had like doubts in the beginning.
Yeah,
it's like, well, this is what you have been doing for the last 15 years.
Yeah.
But it also made it better and you know, made the mix better. And it's funny now, because obviously you don't have that same exact system everywhere you go,
right?
So now even though they, thank God, are quite common nowadays, especially on outdoor festivals and stuff. But you sometimes go back to like a not so advanced system or an older system. And even those mixes are sounding better now, because what you're sending out of the console is already way more precise.
Yeah.
Because you can hear it on this, you know, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. Like for me, this was a very, very interesting process over this tour and like the tours after. Because I like realized, okay, there's a lot of, I can do a lot more work here and in this part and on that part.
Yeah.
Where I would have said a couple of months earlier, no, this, you know, this is going to be as good as it gets. There's there's nothing more to gain here.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, I like it, because it also means that it doesn't make the job
boring
so to speak, you know, because you're always aiming and trying to find something to make it a little bit better.
So you started early enough to where you obviously started on analog consoles, and so what was that transition like for you, and when did it happen?
I know the exact time when it happened.
Yeah.
refused for a very long time to change, because every single time I had a digital console in my hands before that was just like, what is this? You know, yeah. What this does not, it feels like a toy. It sounds like a toy. This is not what I want. And then we were on Gigantour with Megadeth in the US.
And Dream Theater. I saw that.
No, it wasn't Dream Theater.
Oh, I didn't know they did more than one Gigantour.
Oh, yeah.
This one was like Lamb of God and Megadeth and
exactly.
Dream Theater.
We were on the one with Lamb of God.
This is the same one. Dream Theater was on it.
No.
Huh.
We didn't tour with Dream Theater.
Huh. So. Interesting. Maybe they just did whatever part of it or something. Yeah.
It was it must have been early-ish 2000s as well. 2005, 2006, something like that.
Yeah, I saw it in Orlando at the Hard Rock Live in Orlando. I'm a big Dream Theater fan, you know, progressive prog rock.
Dream Theater? I don't know. I don't think it was Dream Theater.
Yeah.
I would remember Dream Theater.
Well, I only went for Dream Theater. Lamb of God and If It Was Your Band and some of the other ones were like, oh my God, what am I listening to right now?
It was definitely High on Fire. I think... Bodom. I don't remember. It doesn't matter. At that time, though, the guy who did front of house for Megadeth was a friend of mine, and he actually called me or emailed me before the tour, and he basically was like, "Okay, we have two choices. It's like either I can take a Midas Heritage for me." Which is an analog console, and all the supports are going to get like a cheap Yamaha, whatever the Yamaha of the day was back then. Or we can all agree on taking a DigiDesign D-Show console and share that between all of us. And I'm like, well, you know, if you ask me like that, then I would prefer the DigiDesign, because I know that at least like one of the most decent consoles at that time, and then 3 weeks later or whatever, the tour started and we had like a production day somewhere in the US, and that was the first time I started mixing on a digital console.
You just jumped
like
right
on
into
tour,
the deep end, right?
Basically.
straight into the deep end.
And then I mean that was it's really funny, because we're still using, like, DigiDesign became Avid, and, you know, Avid had, like, a bunch of different consoles, and now the latest they released the S6 or S6L platform.
Yeah.
We switched to that, I don't know, 5 years ago or something like that.
Always stayed with the same brand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's like all the integration with all the, like, we're using very heavy snapshots, for instance, which is a little bit uncommon for like a metal band or whatever, you know, and the integration with Pro Tools and the recording and virtual sound check, where you can just play back stuff through the PA, be it for yourself to work on something, or if a musician wants to hear something, or, you know, it's all very, very easy. And in the beginning, Avid or DigiDesign back then were really the only guys where this was doable.
Yeah.
Now you can do it with a lot more consoles, obviously, and also with a lot cheaper consoles. Like,
yeah.
You know. Technology here as well evolved like crazy, basically, you know. But for me, this was one of like the key moments, because like when I was still with analog gear, I remember I would like write myself cue cards for each song, which is basically like an analog form of snapshots, where, you know, I would note down like delay times or in reverb types and shit like that. And like back then I would mid-song, I would already start thinking about what I need to do break between the two songs to make, you know, to set up for the next one. And it takes away a lot of concentration, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that you don't really realize. But once you have a tool like the snapshot thing where you can store stuff, you finally realize it's like, oh, actually, you know, now I don't need to think about this anymore. And it frees up my head and my time to actually do what the band is paying me for, which is mix a show. Yeah. So on that tour, like halfway through, it was a pretty long tour. It was almost 2 months, I think. And halfway through, I started getting into snapshots and stuff and try out this technology. And then I actually immediately started to like it because I saw the potential. It wasn't necessarily there sound-wise yet. But now I think it's very close.
Like there's not still a warmth that you get from analog consoles that's better or whatever.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, I would still take out an analog console if we would only do arenas and money was no object. And it's like, if I could choose, I would maybe try it out. It would always be with like a digital sidecar.
Yeah.
It does all the automation stuff.
Yeah.
Because at this point, there's so much automation going on during the show that is also these little details that I would just miss because you can't physically do it on an analog console unless you have like three people pushing buttons or whatever.
Yeah.
So this is for me like an overall package thing where I think, okay, the advantages of the digital world definitely outweigh taking an analog console.
Yeah.
Whereas coming back to guitar amps, that's not there yet because, you know, especially when we do like headline tours or it's not fly shows where it matters if you take like a Marshall head or a tiny little digital box, it makes no difference to me. And then I would always choose the analog amp.
Yeah.
But I mean, we just did Australia and Asia, for instance, where we had to fly almost every second day. And we take a neural DSP gear there as well.
Yeah.
Because obviously the advantage of moving around so much outweighs carrying a tube amp that possibly gets broken by the airline. So, you know, you have to
interesting
pick your battles, so to speak.
Yeah.
But,
So you think guitar amplifiers are getting close to a point where nobody will be using tube amplifiers anymore and all the modeling amplifiers and stuff are going to take over? No.
I think it's like vinyl. There will be a big, I don't think it will go away completely, just like vinyl never did.
Yeah.
You know, there was always this freaks somewhere that would keep building their record collection. And I mean, now
I have a house up in Canada in the mountains, and one of my plans because I spend the warm months there from May until September, October or whatever. And one of my plans this year is to buy a turntable and a bunch of vinyl to start collecting back. I got rid of all my vinyl, I don't know, 30 years ago or something. And now I'm going to start collecting it again at like 20 times the price or whatever. Right.
Like, probably. Yeah.
More than
no,
times.
I don't think this will go away at all.
So aside from like you've had two major shifts in technology, I think in audio, obviously line array and digital consoles.
Yeah.
Has there been like mic technology or other things? Power, obviously digital power has changed some things, but has there been any revolutionary changes?
That's the two major things. Like digital consoles definitely being like, I would say that's even bigger than the line array technology. Line array probably the second one. But I mean, other than that, it's very
Well, digital consoles is such a big topic too, because, you know, Dante and all of the plugins and that whole universe.
It's not just the
control surface itself. It's all of the other stuff that came with it, right?
I mean, yeah, and that actually, I would, if you would separate that a little bit, that part from the console, like the DSP power, processing power, is maybe the third one.
Yeah.
Because that's obviously not only a thing in consoles, but it's also in like reverb units or even the guitar processing and stuff, the modeling amps and blah, blah, blah. That would have not been possible without having this ginormous amount of processing power basically in your hand. I mean, you also experienced the birth of cell phones and how this looked in the beginning and like the basically first laptops and how laptops look now.
Of course,
Like I was also in the middle of all this when I grew up, and this is like, you know, what used to be a suitcase-sized thing is now basically in your hand, and even more than that. So it's
well,
it's
they always
crazy.
Compare. They always compare like the iPhone, the power of an iPhone to like the original space shuttle. This has more computing power than the original space shuttle, which is incredible.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So what was I going to ask you? Oh. So you use DMB, I guess, pretty much exclusively, if you can.
If I can.
Yeah.
It's, you know, so I have a very good relationship with them because that's basically what I grew up on.
Of course.
Like on their PAs, like from 20 years ago, that the club I started to work in here in Salzburg just had a DMB install. And that's when I had my first contact. So I know a lot of people there and.
I always like it to
semi-close proximity and it's like they like me for some reason and they always, you know, I can give feedback on certain things and
that's cool.
And it's always nice to do things like that.
You know, I'm old enough. I started in the industry on the lighting side, and I came into lighting right when automated lighting was becoming a thing. And so the whole transition from, you know, fixed park hands and things. So, you know, when I started, most shows were still mostly park hands. Occasionally you had somebody who had some Verilights, but that was it, right? And then the companies I was working with were creating alternatives to the Verilights. And so I just saw something similar. I remember when I saw my first moving light and I was like, whoa, you know, nobody's ever going to use a fixed position light again. Why would you, you know, when you can move it and change color, why would you use a light that just does one thing? I recently, so I'm from Calgary, Canada. And last summer when I was there, my house is just outside of Calgary in the mountains. And when I was there last summer, I was invited to PK Sound to see their system. And I didn't really know what I was walking into, right? And I went into their showroom and they said, you know, here's a typical setup for an installation. But let's say there's suddenly a 12-foot wide column right in front of your speakers, and, you know, you're missing sound to a big part of the venue or whatever. And the rig started moving and I was like, what the hell is going on here? And they showed it to me on the screen, what was happening and all the science behind it. And I was just blown away. And I remember feeling the same thing. Like, why would anyone want a rig that you can't adjust in the air once you see this technology, you know? And, but I think, you know, the challenge to that is obviously that it's kind of like Betamax, where everybody knew Betamax was better, but because it was only available from Sony in that one device, it didn't make much sense, where VHS, you could get it anywhere, right? And so that might become a problem where people don't want to change brands just to get that feature. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about...
Yeah. I, it's funny because like Daryl is on me all the time as well when we're in Canada to come and see one of their systems.
Yeah.
So I mean, I heard of it, and I know that it's like self-adjusting, so to speak.
Yeah.
But I don't know. There's a lot of there's nothing that it does that you can't really do with something else either. Other than like, I can't think of a situation where I'm like setting it up in the morning and then all of a sudden I have the urge or the need to move it again.
Yeah.
So that's where I see the issue with that, and then it's very heavy as far as I know.
Yeah.
Obviously, because there's motors in it.
Yeah. And built into the box.
And I mean, EAW tried something similar, if I remember correctly, with the Anya a couple of years back.
I just find it intriguing, you know, like to me. When I saw it, I was like, wow, you know?
It's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
That's for sure. I'm not sure how practical it is, like in a real world.
Yeah.
Doing 300 shows a year type of situation.
Yeah.
But, you know, who knows?
Yeah. Interesting.
For me, this is always very... like I got asked a couple of times, like in Frankfurt or whatever, on the ProLite and sound, it's like, where do you think a certain technology is going or whatever? It's like, I don't know. It's like, I just use it. You know,
did you go to the show this year?
No. ProLite and sound has been dead for a couple of years now.
Since it split with Mesa, right?
Was it a complete? I don't remember how that happened.
Well, Mesa canceled and hasn't come back. So.
Oh, it hasn't. Oh, that's true. It hasn't come back at all.
It hasn't come back.
Yeah.
Because it used to be such a huge show. Like, I used to go to Music Mesa and, ProLite every year.
Crazy.
And it was just such a massive show. You had to take the bus to get from, you know, the sound pavilion to the lighting pavilion or whatever, right?
Hold on one second.
Now it's much smaller. Yeah. So, you know, you gave us back a funny statement when she asked you, you know, just funny stories of being on the road for 25 years with this band and, you know, being their babysitter. And, you know, I mean, that's so typical. Rock bands in particular, I think, worse than pop artists. Like, pop artists, I think, have... sort of, there's a list of things that every pop artist is going to do wrong or whatever, but rock bands are looking for trouble. Like, rock bands started the whole thing of throwing televisions out hotel windows and flipping cars over. And, you know, I remember one time we took furniture out of all the hotel rooms and we furnished the elevators, and we were like, betting on who could furnish the elevator better. Like, there were six elevators or whatever, and we furnished the elevators with plants and televisions and couches and everything, right? It's just stupid things you do when you're bored, you know? But, you know, you mentioned one story in particular about running around South America with lots of cash. And it's funny because when I was early with Martin Lighting, I remember we had a guy who was relatively new with us. Now he works for Robe Lighting, but he was new with us at the time. And he had to go with one of our salespeople down to, he was a guy who did the demos, like he controlled the lights and stuff during demos. And he had to go to South America to show off some new technology in a few different countries. And the first country they went to, it was him and one of our salespeople, first country they went to paid us like $60,000 in cash or something to pay off something on their account. And he was so nervous because he was traveling all over South America with this $60,000 in cash in his suitcase. And he had to keep checking that box saying, I don't have more than $10,000 in cash or whatever.
Yeah.
And he was so nervous. So your statement reminded me of that.
Yeah. I mean, thank God those days are basically over.
Yeah.
And it, to me, it was always very bizarre anyway, because it's like, I mean, in South America, okay, that's one thing. Like, especially in the earlier days, it was pretty much like a Wild West
Yeah.
type of situation. And you knew that.
Yeah.
But even in the US, there was so many things that were handled cash, where I'm like, what do you want me to do with this? This is
Yeah.
like, why, just wire it.
Yeah.
What do you mean? And this is like literally just like 15 years ago, where
It's crazy.
it was either cash or it was a check.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm European. I have never seen a check in my life.
It's
You know what I
crazy.
mean? I have a
Yeah.
bank account and a card, and you
Yeah.
can wire to this bank account. This is how it works. Like,
Yeah.
how are you not? This
It's
was
true.
very bizarre for me.
Yeah.
But on this was one of the first, like the note that I wrote. This was one of the first South American runs I did, and it just kept piling on. And I had like this little like Tumi weekender bag basically. And by the end of the run, it wasn't even that long. It was like 10 days or 2 weeks or something. It was literally it was filled to the top with fucking US dollars.
Oh my
And
God.
it was not a comfortable
No.
no. And
No,
I mean,
that's
I
no
would
fun.
definitely I wouldn't do something like that nowadays. I would just refuse. It's like, yeah,
Yeah.
it's not. You talk to the agent and you figure it out how we get the money. I don't care. You know,
It's
it's
funny because until very recently, like I talked to a lot of tour managers and stuff, and until very recently, settlements were done in cash. And
Oh, it's not like they're gone. We just did South America in November, December last year, and there was a bunch of them that were like, "Oh yeah, we couldn't get to the bank to wire it in time, so we're gonna pay you the balance in cash." No, you're not. I'm
oh
not
my
picking up
God.
fucking 50 grand or whatever.
No.
You know, it's like, are
Yeah.
you insane? It's
Yeah.
like I have 3 weeks to go. I'm going to like in Colombia, and you know, I have no intention to carry
No.
that amount of money. You
No.
know, this is
Well, and I
like,
mean
this
the
is
same,
insane.
by the way, the same person at the venue who did that settlement for 50,000 in cash, he's calling up his brother and saying, "Hey, they're driving a
Exactly.
white van, and they're going from here to
Exactly.
Bolivia, and they're going to cross this road right here, you know, and then your car is getting attacked by a bunch of guys jumping out of the jungle or something, and you lose the money, right? So, yeah, I
I
mean,
mean,
I wouldn't put it past them.
it was pretty dumb, so to speak, to do it back in the day. But it
Yeah.
was also, I mean, it was also obviously way different
Of
sums
course,
we were
yeah.
talking. And I just think in general, it changed. Like back then, it was more like, you know, if you could take, if you have worked with certain promoters a couple of times, you could take their word for it. And you know, it was kind of, it had this type of quality, which was nice.
Yeah.
And nowadays, it's
It's
either
all business.
super corporate,
Yeah.
it's super shady. There's
Really?
nothing in between anymore. You know, I'm lucky to be on the super corporate type
Yeah.
or side of things, where I don't have to worry about these type of situations most
Yeah.
of the time.
Yeah.
But yeah,
The big pop, the big pop in country tours and stuff. You know, I refer to this article all the time, but I read an article from Rapino from Live Nation, and he says that the reason that tours just keep growing and growing and growing and ticket sales are so crazy and all of this stuff is because of social media followings. You know, these artists might have 10 million followers on social media. And he said, "My job's easy. All I got to do is sell tickets to 5% of them." And, but in the metal genre, I would think that it's not so much like that. Like, or is it also driven by social media and,
I think it got a lot more important, maybe later than in other genres, but by now you can definitely tell that there is some bands that do really well, partly because of how they deal with their social media,
right?
Yeah. And how well they actually play it. You know, there's I can't think of anybody right now, but there's definitely a few out there that wouldn't be as big as they are if it wouldn't be partly because of social media.
Yeah.
But then again, I mean, you know, people are not stupid. Either audiences are not stupid. Nowadays, if you don't deliver a certain quality of show, they go once and that's it. And then that doesn't really help anyone either, because sooner or later you're going to run out of people to sell tickets
to.
Yeah,
exactly.
Know?
Exactly.
But it's a very bizarre time now, post COVID, so to speak, anyway, because there's all this, you know, you hear it everywhere. Oh, the cost of living just exploded. People don't have any money anymore. Everything is so expensive, especially over here in Europe with like electricity and gas and whatnot.
Brutal.
With the war in Ukraine and all this bullshit going on. But on the other hand, like whatever, Taylor Swift or Coldplay, who play like 10 shows in the same city, you know, for ticket prices that are like
ridiculous.
Way higher than
yeah.
probably any metal tour ever.
Yeah.
And at the same time, like what we've seen or what I've seen with a bunch of bands is merch sales are crazy after COVID. You know,
it's wild,
when we went to certain cities where we would do, I don't know, $5 a head, it's 10 now.
Yeah.
And it's like, how is that possible? Like, I don't get it.
And they'll buy anything.
This doesn't really go together with what, you know, you read everywhere that
you know,
like, people don't have any money. It's like, okay, obviously they do have money. They just spend it way differently than what they did like 3 years ago.
I was talking recently with someone in the confetti business, and they said like after a show, like a Taylor Swift show or something, people are on eBay selling pieces of confetti for like $20 or 20 euro or whatever, right? For a little tiny bag of pieces of confetti that were blown off in the show two nights earlier or something. It's shocking to me. It's shocking.
Yeah, that's
to me.
Crazy.
And that's probably
the
people who are sweeping up the stadium floor or whatever, you know. It's probably those people who got smart and said, I'm going to sell this shit on eBay. And they're filling their pockets and bags with confetti and stuff, right?
But more crazy to me than selling it is actually that there's people out there who actually will buy that. That is something that
it's
completely do not understand.
Well,
it's
remember,
like,
people will pay $1 million for like a, what was it, a grilled cheese sandwich or whatever, because it looked like Jesus.
Oh,
I forget the story, but, you know, people will pay.
Yeah.
There's so much money out there right now that seems to, a lot of it is in the hands of really stupid people who will spend any amount of money to buy things. And, you know, like I'm a
true.
Big fan of, I'm a big fan of classic cars, classic sports cars, Camaros and, you know, all kinds of them, Cutlass and all of the beautiful cars from the 60s and stuff, Corvettes.
Yeah.
And the pricing now is so insane, you know, it's completely insane. It's, I don't know. There's a lot of money out there, you know?
Yeah.
And
I mean, it has to be. It's,
yeah.
Yeah. I can't really.
Does most
understand.
Of your, does most of your work come from touring or festivals? I know festivals, especially in metal, festivals are huge in Europe still, right? But
yeah, I mean, they're huge. There's huge festivals everywhere, I would say. I mean, the Europeans obviously invented the like 3-day type of camping, blah, blah, blah. That, to my knowledge, at least, that didn't exist in the US before Coachella.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really exist other than with Coachella either.
Yeah.
You know. But it's, usually like there's always a good amount of festivals on every cycle.
Yeah.
You usually do like on an album cycle, you might do 2 to 3 summers of festivals, you know, the big important ones in the first year when the album came out, and then like the secondary ones that you couldn't do because of date clashes or whatever. You do the second year, and then you go to the obscure ones, so to speak, like that are in the wilder countries in the third year. So it's a lot, but it's also very compressed in time. So
yeah, but I remember somebody recently in the Netherlands was telling me, touring's not so big in the Netherlands. And I said, oh, that's too bad. So you don't get to see much live music. And he said, no, there are, I forget the number. I think it was 1500 festivals in the Netherlands.
Oh, that's, I'm
just like,
festivals.
What? You know, it's a small country of what, 5 million people or something. I don't even remember, but you know, 1500 Holland, festivals.
Netherlands and Belgium is special because it's very, they pump a lot of government money into the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, one of the best European festivals, in my opinion, for the metal genre is definitely Kaspop in Belgium, because everything is just perfect. The whole infrastructure with the way that backstage is set up. It's, even if the weather is not good, you're not in the mud. It's not, you know, you have like proper facilities with like showers and bathrooms, and it's all really, really nice and really well done.
Yeah.
And that's very unique to like Belgium and Netherlands. Like all the smaller, there's a lot of smallish clubs in the Netherlands that like between 1,000 to like 1,500, 3,000 people or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're all like purpose-built venues, with the little details that are important. A lot of dressing rooms, a big enough freight elevator or whatever. Most of the time, what they do is they build buildings where they have like 3 capacity sizes in the same building.
Wow!
So you can be a band that's on the verge and you get booked in the 500 capacity, and all of a sudden, let's move it.
We
in the
made it to the big room.
Stuff like that, but it all makes a lot of sense. You can tell that there's a lot of government money spent, because obviously some people in the government value that this is actually important to people.
Well, and
I mean,
they're making tax dollars off of it too.
And live entertainment, whatever genre it might be, is important to the people.
Yeah,
you know, it's important for mental health, as we have seen a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
That it's not good
no kidding
if everything just stops.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, I don't, it's, it, to me, it's very bizarre that this is so spotty, so to speak, why is there not more money spent on all, this could be all a much nicer experience for everyone, you know, for the people working the industry.
I agree.
For the people who go to the shows. It's not rocket science, you know, and it's obviously still big business.
Yeah.
Like there's good money to be made.
Of course.
So
yeah.
It's,
when did you get back to work after COVID? Speaking of COVID.
We did our first tour in 2022.
Okay.
March, so February 22.
You had pretty much 2 full years off then.
I had almost exactly 2 years off.
Yeah.
For us, it was very bizarre because we were going to do Australia and Asia. And then quite late in the game, they booked 2 shows in Russia right before that. So our last show before COVID hit was St. Petersburg. And then we flew to Auckland in New Zealand just to basically meet at the lobby of the hotel
And then turn around.
Well, we slept one night, and then we flew back home the next day.
Long ass flight to do an overnight, stay.
Which was bizarre. And then I remember I got back home on the, I arrived in Auckland on a Friday Saturday morning. I flew back home on Sunday, and I arrived at 5 or 6 in the morning in Vienna on the first day of our first lockdown. Oh. And it was just bizarre when I got out of the plane. There was like 3 people at the airport. What? And then I took there's like a 2.5 hour train ride from Vienna to Salzburg. Again, I think I was the only one on the train.
Oh my God.
And it was just, it was like somebody wiped out the all the people.
Yeah, it was like a bad sci-fi movie.
It was crazy. Yeah. Absolutely crazy, you know. Mm. And I mean, now obviously it's especially crazy with thinking that like playing shows in Russia is, you know, this is, I mean, it's not going to happen again in my lifetime. I don't know.
You don't think so?
I'm 100% sure that really? We're not going to go back. Yeah, this is not happening. Huh. This is going to take way, way too long to reestablish.
To sort it out, yeah. Yeah.
If it's even going to happen. I mean, we'll see what...
I don't know, you know.
What happens with the orange one in September and then how that plays out in terms of Ukraine and Russia, and maybe we have bigger issues come January anyway, but I don't see any real touring going back there anytime soon.
No. Interesting because I think as a world we have a short memory, and you know, like, remember all the changes that we were going to make during COVID. Oh, we'll never do this again. And we're going to do it like this in the future. And now we're going to change all of these things. And it's going to be much safer and much better. And we're going to treat our people better and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Bullshit.
Yeah.
Bullshit. Yeah, yeah. You know, here we are a few years later and we're worse than we were in 2019 in most ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I agree. It's crazy.
Yeah. Sarah put a question in here that said, are there any frameworks, methods, or processes that you found to be especially useful in your work that others may find useful too? And you gave us an answer, but do you remember what you answered?
I think it was the thing that what originally drew me to the audio things. Which is the fact that you can basically try anything. There is obviously certain physical rules that apply, you know, just like with a lot of other or most other jobs as well. But I mean, one thing specifically would be that if you have 2 mics on the snare drum, that you always have to turn the bottom one in phase, so it's, as a whole, it's in phase again. And that's one of that's the rule. You have to do it. No, you don't. You know, you don't have to do it because, yes, it makes sense. And on paper and, you know, if you calculate it, it's probably right that you have to do it. But you might actually get the result that you are looking for with not doing it.
Yeah.
As an example. Yeah. It's like what I like about it is doing stuff differently just to try it, not for the sake of it, but you know, try it out.
Yeah,
there's nothing, it's not going to hurt anyone, it's not going to destroy anything.
Yeah,
but where are you getting with this when you try things out? And I think that's a very interesting thing to do in general. Like I still to this day after more than 20 years just, you know, wipe out all my EQs, for instance, on a show file and like redo it or do it with a different plugin or do it completely.
That's interesting.
You know, try out things that I've never tried before, you know, and with some things, it's definitely, you know, don't never change a running system. Like,
yeah,
you shouldn't, this has been tried and tested for 30 years.
Yeah.
Let's keep it like this because it's fine. But on other things, it's like, oh, this is crazy.
Yeah.
This is actually awesome how good that works. And different artists or different genres require different solutions and stuff. So it's like, it's one way of like keeping myself on my toes, so to speak, a little bit.
Yeah.
To keep like learning more or new things.
Yeah.
That, you know, sometimes I'm like, okay, I try something, it doesn't work for what I'm trying to do. And then years later, I'm doing something completely else. And I remember, oh, I tried this once and I do it in this different application.
That's
and
perfect.
It's like, oh, this is great.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And this is what it should be in my opinion, or this is why I like my job as much as I do.
I like that concept because I think you have to challenge, you know, the norm or challenge the rules or break the rules. You have to break things in order to figure out how to make them better sometimes. Right.
And absolutely. Yeah, yeah,
I always use racing examples because my son is a racing driver, but he grew up in go-karts. And when he first started karting and he was frustrated that he wasn't getting faster and stuff, one of the things we did is I would pay him $5 every time he went off at a corner and hit the barrier. I would pay him to hit the barrier. And the reason I was doing this was because he was forcing himself to carry more speed through those corners. And mm-hmm. when he found the limit, you'd have to go over the limit to find the limit, right? So he'd
exactly,
go over the
yeah.
limit, hit the barrier, and now he knew, I just got to lift a tiny bit sooner, or I got to brake a bit sooner, a bit harder, or whatever.
Yeah, and yeah, yeah.
So he was learning highly valuable lessons that were making him a much better driver. It was only costing me $5, and he didn't get hurt. You know, the barriers were soft,
yeah, yeah.
and it wasn't going to hurt him or anything. And yeah. it got over the fear of going off track too, you know, because every yeah. other driver was lifting really early, braking really hard, etc. So anyways, yeah. tell me about, speaking of Russia, there's something here about naked musicians in trains,
yeah.
which sounds like a good name yeah. for a metal yeah. song, naked musicians in Russian trains, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah. That's also a long time ago. We used to take the night train from St. Petersburg to Moscow or the other way.
Yeah.
So it would basically be do a show in the one city, pack up, go to the train station, get on the train at like 1 a.m, and then sleep on the train.
It's such a glamorous life, isn't it?
It was awesome.
I'm joking.
I mean, now it's fine because they have this high speed train now between the two cities, which is only like 3 hours or something,
yeah, yeah.
which is a little bit more comfortable.
Yeah.
But there was nothing wrong with it. And it was always like, you know, it was always a party, basically.
Mm.
And that's how it is. The naked musicians came.
They
came
just decided to take
basically
their clothes off.
Because, no, it's like Scandinavian people, for some reason, get naked in the most bizarre
well, because they're drunk
yeah but not sometimes they're sober as well they just don't
oh my God.
This was like something new to me as well in the very beginning starting with these guys and also with other Scandinavian bands. It's like they just don't, I don't know, they feel the urge sometimes to do it. I don't know, maybe it's the Finnish sauna mentality or
Russia. Russia to me seems like the wrong place to do this though, you know, like
that's where the alcohol comes in.
Yeah. This just seems like the wrong place to do it. Like some big burly Russian is going to come and say nyet. You know.
That happened also. It was a very big Russian lady that came from the what do you call it? Like the restaurant cart, basically
oh, yeah.
came
yeah.
back to our thing and was like, "Don't do that again," because somebody dared him to run, like basically all the way through the train and come back.
No,
it wasn't only our. It wasn't only our car. It was like,
oh,
he literally
no.
went,
oh my God.
All the way through. And he made it and nothing happened. So it's fine.
Hey, yeah,
I
yeah.
mean, the same guy was chased by Japanese hotel security in Tokyo through the hallways and stuff.
You weren't married at the time, right?
No.
Because I just wonder if that's a story that you call your wife and say, oh, yeah, did anything happen today, honey? Well, yeah, we kind of got in trouble for running naked through the train, you know, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, I would definitely tell her those stories.
Really?
It's one of, yeah.
She from the industry?
Nothing really ever happened that had, like, bad consequences.
Yeah.
And there was some really stupid things done back in the day. And even now, I mean, I had musicians arrested for various reasons. And it was always like, okay, slap on the wrist. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Ay, ay, ay.
That's hilarious. I think as long as you're not a complete idiot, the time when you face like an authority.
Yeah.
Then you're usually good.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's hilarious.
And then if not, you just go to jail for a night.
So I know you've been drinking wine during this recording, and it's morning for me, so I'm jealous, but and you've mentioned that you love champagne.
That was actually champagne as well.
Oh, was it?
Drinking
champagne. I like it.
Yes,
but you're also a big coffee guy.
Yes.
Is that because of like the drug in coffee that keeps you awake and makes you buzzed, or is it the flavor and stuff, which is why I like it?
No, I mean, Austria having a very vast coffee house tradition, that's definitely one thing.
Yeah, I didn't know that about Austria.
And then, oh, Vienna is fucking full of it. And
I didn't know that. I had no idea.
The oldest coffee cafes in the world.
Really?
You know, together.
I didn't know that. I've never been to Austria. I've been to many places, but I've never been to Austria. I want to.
I always wanted to go
because I grew up in Canada skiing, you know, and I always wanted to go to Austria skiing even, you know, but I just never got there. Never got
I mean, that's definitely a big part of it. And then obviously being very close to Italy and spending lots and lots of childhood family vacations in Italy.
Yeah.
That's another, I think. And so, it's like, I'm not a nerdy coffee drinker.
Yeah.
Like, you know, searching for and I need to try this new bean and that new bean or whatever. Like, I bought myself a espresso machine right at the beginning of when COVID hit.
Yeah.
Because obviously they closed all the cafes.
Right, yeah.
And I was like, okay, I need to have something
at
home.
No.
And it was from the beginning that I was just in search of the, let's call it the perfect espresso.
Yeah.
Like what the, you know, the port or shipyard worker in Napoli, what they drink as coffee, the 1 euro at the bar in the morning, one zip and that's it. And that's what I basically have. I have like 2-3 different beans that I change up every now and then, but that's it. I mainly
Here's what we're going to do. Sarah's going to reach out and get your address, and we're going to send you, we have a relationship with a local coffee maker here. So it's a guy from our industry who took on a passion for coffee. And at some point he bought a small roaster and put it in his garage and he really learned, and he flew around all over the world, figuring out, learning the best beans and things. And it became such a passion that eventually people started saying, Jamie, your coffee is amazing. Can you make me a bag of it? Can you make me? So he was giving it away to all his friends. And then they were saying, well, my buddy wants one. Can I buy one? And so long story short, it became a business called Coffee Cult with K's. Like German. And and so
I think I've seen this before.
So we created, so I started drinking it just as a customer, and I love dark coffee. So I make like a regular American cup of coffee from a nice espresso machine that is a DeLonghi automatic machine, very easy to use and really nice. And so I drink regular coffee and espresso, but I usually drink like an American tall coffee, you know. And so I would drink the dark one, and my girlfriend was like, oh, it's too strong for me. And so I started mixing their medium roast and this particular dark roast, which was called Road Dog, and because he's from our industry. And so it was perfect. And so one time I told him, you know, I mixed these, and he goes, well, we should make you a custom blend, and we'll just blend them together in one bag.
That's awesome.
So we did that, and we called it Geezer's Grind. And so now it's branded.
Fantastic.
So the cool thing is, all of the proceeds from that coffee go to our industry for people who got injured or don't have health insurance or have a problem or mental health, whatever it is. But it goes to a charity to support our industry. And so anyways, long story short, it's a really good coffee, and we'll have Sarah get your address, and we'll figure out a way to ship a bag of it over to Austria.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So, and I share your passion for coffee, but I'm not, you know, I'm Canadian. Our coffee is terrible in Canada. We have this place called Tim Hortons. Tim Hortons, I don't know if you know, but he was a very good hockey player. And he started this chain of coffee shops. He just died a few years ago, I think, actually. But their coffee is terrible, you know, and compared to what you drink and what I drink now.
I mean, well, nowadays I have to say it's a lot easier to get good and decent coffee. You know, because in the beginning, in especially in the US, it was difficult. There was nothing.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, okay, Starbucks, which at least it's like, okay, at least it's consistent.
Decent. Yeah.
It's not great, but it's not, at least it's not like truck stop coffee.
Yeah.
You know, but nowadays,
but it's $7, which pisses me off, you know, like a cup of coffee is $7. It's so stupid.
And like you said, in
Italy, you know, you go to a little cafe and it's €1 and it's 10 times better. You know?
But we actually have within In Flames Crew, we have this unofficial coffee club. It's the lighting guy, one of the guitar techs, and me, who basically we try to, like, every day on a show day, we try to go out and, like,
find,
you know,
the best coffee.
Find a good espresso within the vicinity of the venue.
You know, it's so funny because 30 years ago you would have been looking for a strip club. Now you're looking for a cup of coffee. it's so funny. How things have changed, right?
Yes.
Thomas, I appreciate you taking the time today to do this with us, and it's been a pleasure getting to know you. And like I said, we'll get you a bag of coffee somehow, and as much as I'm not a massive fan of the music, if I see you popping around Florida at any point, I'll make a point of reaching out and coming to see you.
Absolutely. Please do.
All right, my friend. Thanks so much, and have a great one.
Thank you. You too.